to the Ad Fontes podcast, live from the 2022 Convivium Irenicum. I'm joined, as always, or at least most of the time, by my co-host, Colin Chan Redimer, the poetry editor of Ad Fontes. And today we have special guest Samuel Bray, a law professor at the University of Notre Dame, and the famous, in our circles anyway, editor of the Book of Common Prayer International Edition, 1662. So, Sam, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
And the newest board member of the Davenant Institute.
He's the newest. I didn't know he was the newest. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah.
It's great to be with you.
Well, we're here at the Convivium, which everybody knows is a really good time. We often describe it as, and you can tell us whether or not you think this is an apt description, but here's how we explain ourselves. You have to kind of make a Venn diagram, and so it's one part kind of pastor's retreat. There's a spiritual directional, you know, prayer orientation element. One part academic theology philosophy conference, a lot of intellectual, you know, heavy hitting big ideas, and then one part kind of like a hunting or fishing trip with your buddies. If you imagine the
with all the alcohol and tobacco, but none of the hunting or fishing.
Right. If you imagine the intersection of those Venn diagrams, that's sort of what I think we've invited you to. Does that feel like an apt description?
I think that's pretty good. I would say the circles are not all the same size. I think there's probably more time on the theology and philosophy, but all three of those circles are there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and normally when we have people come on, this is our second time, actually, I think, doing a podcast from the Convivium. And
that's
so,
right.
But we've talked about the Convivium before on the podcast. Normally, we're almost always talking about the content. So we're usually talking about philosophy, theology, different topics, whoever's speaking. And we'll probably get into some of that. But we really were excited to have you here because starting last year, we've always done prayer, right? We say prayer's an important part of it. You know, we begin and end every day with prayer. We pray before the meals. And it's pretty substantial. There's lots of standing, kneeling, you know, these kinds of things. But starting last year, we started
starting
using the 1662 prayer book. And you're the editor. And so we thought, actually, this year, you know, we want to be good Christians. We don't want to talk philosophy. We want to talk prayer. And so we figured there's nobody better to talk prayer with than yourself.
I'd be delighted to.
So we were talking earlier, and you know, you were you know everything, as far as I could tell, about the prayer book that I could possibly ever want to know. Like, I don't know anything about Cranmer, and you know everything. So can you just in 30 seconds or less tell us everything that we need to know about Cranmer?
Well, I don't know everything, but I do know Drew Keene, and my co-editor, and he does know everything.
Oh, okay. So we'll have to run another one of these with Drew.
That's right.
But I'm happy to talk. So Cranmer is the leading English reformer, not the only English reformer, but he's the one who it's hard to see it turning out the way it did without him. Unlike the reformers in some other countries, he doesn't leave behind a systematic theology and institutes, for example, mm-hmm. like Calvin does. His chief and most important legacy is the Book of Common Prayer. It's not the only part of the English Reformation. There's a statement of faith, 39 articles, there are homilies, because he wants people to have preaching, but the liturgy is front and central in the English Reformation, thanks to Cranmer. And it's not utterly unique, but it is distinctive.
Yeah, so after Cranmer starts developing the prayer book, I mean, it goes through, he sort of successfully manages to live through a number of different monarchs. And during that time, the prayer book goes through a number of permutations. And then, you know, once Elizabeth, you know, ascends the throne, there's a kind of stability to the prayer book. And then, you know, about a century later, there's the 1662 Book of Common Prayer, which is now kind of the standard. So can you just kind of walk us through a little bit of that kind of pre-1662 prayer book history into the...
Sure.
My timeline's probably off.
No, but yeah. The timeline's right. So the 1662 is number 5 in the Books of Common Prayer. But some of those are big changes, some are not. So the first one is 1549. That's the big one.
Mm.
This is where Cranmer is putting things into English. So
right.
Now you're going to worship in English. Now,
whoa.
And that's a huge change. So
yeah.
The person in the pews.
Yep.
And by the way, guess when it comes out? Guess when it's like everybody's supposed to use it, all the churches in England. What Sunday is it in 1549? It is Whit Sunday or Pentecost, which is
coming up.
Coming up, yep. two days away. And that's not an accident. So the idea is you are hearing the good news of the gospel in your own language.
The spirit is...
Yes, okay. It is Acts 2 in England on this Sunday in 1549.
And this is under Henry, right?
This is no, this one is under Edward.
Oh, it is.
These are these are both under Edward. So as long as Henry's alive, he can't... As long as Henry's alive, he can't get... he can't make progress on this.
Okay.
Like, he writes an English version of the litany.
Okay.
While Henry's alive. But... So, 1549, and then next up is 1552 prayer book.
Okay.
So, after he does the 1549, he gets into some debates with other bishops like Gardiner, and Gardiner says, look, I'm telling you, you can read this and still find transubstantiation here. And Cranmer is like, we're closing down that loophole.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make sure that you understand what's going on. It's a reformed communion.
Mm.
Christ is truly present for those who are... receiving in faith,
right?
But there is no transubstantiation, and we're gonna tighten the screws, tighten the screws to make sure you don't misunderstand it. Also, prayers for the dead are gone in 1552.
Okay,
but the 1549 is already a very Protestant prayer book.
Okay,
and 1552 is just like further steps that Cranmer probably wanted to do from the beginning.
Now, the 1662, which is the one that we're using, which is, you know, clearly is a little while later, you know, we're being led in morning prayer here at Davenant House by a Lutheran pastor, and the first day of the convivium, he said the 1662 prayer book is, we're not using it because we're making some sort of statement that we're Anglican, you know, sorry, I'm sure the Anglicans in the room would probably want us to be, but the Lutheran pastor says, we're using it because the 1662 represents the common heritage of Reformed prayer books. And you had, I asked you this question earlier, and I think it was just a really valuable answer. What would that even mean? Because it's not like Lutherans go around using the 1662 prayer book in the United States. So how does that end up working historically?
Right. So I think there are two ways in which that's true. One is that Cranmer's working with medieval sources, and a lot of the medieval sources he's working with are, they're not always the same, but a lot of the services are the same shape as what Luther's working with in Germany.
Okay.
And so Luther makes revisions to the Mass. Cranmer makes revisions to the Mass. A lot of points are going to be the same. In fact, Cranmer borrows some prayers from Luther.
Right.
Actually, the flood prayer at the start of baptism. It was used in Wittenberg. So it's a common heritage in the sense that it is a Reformation revision of the common Western heritage. That's part of it. But the real answer, the sort of secret sauce for why Lutherans, Presbyterians in the late 19th century would use liturgies that were often a lot like the Book of Common Prayer.
Yeah, I've been to a Presbyterian church where we used the 1662 Prayer of Confession.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Yeah.
And the reason is just that the language of the 1662 prayer book is so good and so powerful and so adapted to use out loud, unlike a lot of things that are written now, where we don't have as instinctive a feel for the rhythms of spoken prose for a lot of writers. So that it just took off. So when Lutherans, who predominantly use German in their services until the early 20th century, when they're looking for English to use, English versions of the prayers, you just, like, why are you not going to just slide over and use the collects that are in the Book of Common Prayer?
Right. So it's being consulted by people in other traditions as they're trying to figure out how they're going to pray.
In English, and it's
unobjectionable, not least because, you know, when we've been using it here, the overwhelming majority of this is straight out of Scripture. It's just been rearranged in order to be used in a liturgical fashion.
Right. About 80% of the words in the Book of Common Prayer are straight Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing in morning or evening prayer service that would be objectionable across the magisterial Protestant tradition.
Right. Right.
That's great. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Sam, and we kind of talked about this a little bit last night, you know, on the porch, is that the project of revising, updating, and publishing a 1662 international edition is, it seems to be, at least in certain respects, a departure from the kind of traditional Anglican or Episcopal approach where each kind of nation has its own prayer book tradition. The United States had its own prayer book tradition, you know, dating back into the sort of early post-colonial era. I think. Again, my timeline may not be exact. So we were talking a little bit, and I said, you know, Sam, if you wanted to kind of revise the old prayer book tradition, why move to a 1662 International Edition as opposed to trying to revise the 1928 American Book of Common Prayer, which was kind of the last, you know, meaningfully common book of prayer that the Episcopal Church put out? And I think you had some great answers to that, so I just want to...
Ozzy's a fierce patriot at heart, so he feels a, you know, offense
patriotism.
That anyone would want to revise something English but not American. You know, well, Queen's Jubilee be damned.
No shade on fierce patriotism.
I'm a fierce partisan of the, you know, 1928 Episcopal Church. Maybe that's the truth, guys.
Right. So there is something that is in tension between this project and the idea in Cranmer's prefaces to the prayer book and the articles that each national church does get to determine its own customs and its own liturgies and make its own decisions. So you are absolutely right. That's a deeply Anglican idea. It's not just in the United States or the Episcopal Church. On the other hand, those texts are all from a time when you didn't have a thing called Anglicanism.
Right.
You didn't have an international Anglican tradition.
There wasn't an ism that kind of crossed national boundaries. And
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when that ism starts to be recognized in the 19th century, you have things that are the glue that holds everybody together.
Wait, can we go back slightly? Why is there not an Anglicanism? Because the Anglican Church is there, and they've got colonies all over the place, so...
There's the Church of England.
It's just the Church of England.
It's the Church of England, and then the people from the Church of England who are in this country, or that country, or this country, and often missionary efforts.
But does that mean that they're all just, like, looking to Canterbury to solve their problems or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and they don't have... In a lot of these places, you don't have bishops.
Right.
So bishops are all in England.
Would you agree? So I think, I mean, John Henry Newman, if I recall correctly, thinks that the sort of decisive moment in which the Church of England forfeits its claim just to be a national church and becomes a kind of ism that's international is when it establishes a bishopric in Jerusalem. Is that kind of, I mean, do you, you know, where, I mean, I think Newman's argument is, look, England has absolutely no claim to be, you know, doing this in Jerusalem. It's not a national church if it's establishing, you know, sort of autonomous churches in places where autonomous churches have existed, you know, autocephalous churches have existed, you know, in prior times in a place that's not a colony. Is that, do you think fair? Is that the moment we start seeing this?
I disagree. And
okay.
I think what's going on there is that's really the very dated branch theory that Newman's working with, mm-hmm. is that there's like one Catholic church, and the one Catholic church in Italy, it's the Roman Catholic Church, and in England, it's the Church of England,
and
in Russia, it's
yeah.
Right. Which doesn't work for lots of different reasons.
Okay.
But that's the problem. It looks like we're a Protestant church, which Newman didn't want the Church of England to be, but the Church of England has been. From the beginning of the Reformation, it's a Protestant church.
Mm.
So I don't think the Jerusalem thing is particularly significant. I think more significant is the Colenso affair and the establishment of Lambeth. So Lambeth is going to be, you're going to have this like gathering of bishops from around the world, and you're recognizing that they are all there for something and doing something. And the Archbishop of Canterbury is not in a kind of papal role, but more of a convening role. So what is it that the Archbishop of Canterbury is convening?
I see.
And so we got to say what this is, and this is
the council.
Anglicanism.
Right.
Once you recognize that there's an ism or tradition here, it's not just the Church of England and then subordinate national churches, then what begins to happen, because when Cranmer's like talking about national churches or Hooker's talking about this, they're talking about like the church in Sweden. They're not talking about a church that's off of the Church of England that's like in Nigeria or the United States.
Right, right.
So once that happens, what's the glue that holds everybody together? Well, the glue is the 39 articles, a statement of belief, and the ordinal that goes with it, with the prayer book, and critically, the 1662 prayer book.
Right.
So everybody's using it.
Yeah.
And then even in Scotland, they're using the 1662 as much as the Scottish stuff. And the Scottish one is still... like predominantly the same. And so, so everybody's using it. It's the glue that holds everybody together. And that, it's a complicated story. Second half of the 20th century, Gregory Dix, liturgical renewal movement, options, options, options everywhere, totally fragments. And now, there isn't, the same glue. And so lots of people are looking for glue in the Anglican tradition. The formularies do that. And one of the formularies is the 1662.
Got it.
Right. So the answer to my, why not resurrect the 1928 is to say something like, well, look, the American tradition is already fragmented hopelessly. Yeah. So you're not actually going to be able to have a kind of revival movement, of the 28 prayer book. You're not going to be able to get unity around that. And in fact, the ism is now the thing that we have to attend to, this kind of international, you know, tradition. And so the goal then is to kind of bring at least certain segments of American Anglicanism into broader conformity with the, you know, kind of tradition as it exists elsewhere around the world. Is that fair, you think?
Right. You're not, the fragmentation has gotten to a stage where you can't just like tweak it.
You can't put Humpty Dumpty back together, right? Yeah.
Right. And so the 1662 has the advantage of the connection with that global Anglican tradition. It is recognized as a doctrinal authority throughout the Anglican communion.
Mm. Right.
And the 28 is just an American eddy. And it's not, it's a good prayer book, but it's an American eddy. And it's, of course, not even predominantly used in the United States. So the 1662 has those connections. There are other advantages to it. It's the simplest prayer book for a new user. Mm. And doctrinally, it best carries on the Reformation Anglican tradition.
When you say simplest, can you just lay out a little bit of what you mean?
Great. So you open morning prayer.
Yeah.
First thing you got to do is you got to decide the sentences you're going to read.
Mm-hmm.
Once you decide those sentences in the 1662 prayer book, you just march through it, and
you open to one page and you're just going down that page.
The
to the next
only
page.
Choice you have to make is which canticle between two canticles that you're going to read after or sing after each of the lessons.
Got it.
There are no other choices.
Yeah.
And every other prayer book, 28 introduces a number of choices like. You get to choose your creed. You get to choose whether you do the Gloria in Excelsis or the Gloria Patri after each psalm. You get to decide a number of things, but it's nothing like what happens with the late 20th century, early 21st century prayer books where you just have tons of options.
It's like going into the shoe store and just seeing the wall of shoes and you know, it's like, wait, do I want them in red or green? Should there be stripes on them? You know, like, you can't even decide at the end of it.
Yeah. The behavioral psychology experiments about people who are given lots of jam options in the grocery store, and so they don't want any jam because there's just too many
and
jam
they don't
want
to go to the grocery store anymore. The grocery store is out. I'd rather just not pray.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. It's a kind of liturgist playground. Like, well, what if we did this configuration or this one? But it's not designed for the layperson using the service at home who wants to actually just pray and read and not spend all the time customizing.
Yeah. It's the same thing to make another analogy. So we did the shopping analogy. And the other analogy is if you're trying to get somebody to pick up the habit of like going to exercise or whatever, you know, one of the main things you can do is tell them like pack a gym bag and leave it in your trunk so that you never have to think about like, you know, you want to make it easy for yourself, right? You want to treat yourself, you know, give yourself a break if you actually do accomplish the goal.
The 1662 is the pack a gym bag and leave it in the trunk liturgy.
That's right. Yeah. That's good. So the prayer book, right, for people who are not familiar with prayer books, if you're not familiar with prayer books, you're probably also not from a liturgical church, what we would call a liturgical church. But, you know, I would be of the opinion, and I know some friends who are theologians who are in like a Baptist tradition who are theologians of liturgy, and they would say, well, even the non-liturgical churches have a liturgy.
Everyone's got a liturgy.
Everyone's got a liturgy. you are not just a prayer book editor. You're also a law professor. And so I would be intrigued to hear if you think and that's like your day job. I mean, this is what you actually do, is so you teach law at the University of Notre Dame, which I think we introduced with. What is the relationship, if any, between the law and liturgy? You could even begin by just saying, you're clearly a trained lawyer. How did you get into editing the prayer book? I think that might be the first step, and then we can sort of think about law and liturgy.
Well, getting into editing the prayer book would be that I have used the prayer book and love the prayer book, and it's been the center of my devotional life for a long time.
And that was the 1662.
Yes,
you were using.
Eventually, okay. The first prayer book I ever used was a 1979 given to me in my third year in law school by one of my housemates. But then moved back upstream in the tradition.
Yeah.
So
that's a kind of common thing, right? You get the 79, you move to the 28, and then you kind of, you know, go back from there.
He also gave me a book of Charles Simeon's sermons, which were excellent. And another book early on that was formative for me was The Collects of Cranmer by Zoll and Barbee. Works through each of the collects, shows its roots in the ancient church and its devotional force. So
partially devotional, but also it sounds partially like, I don't know, textual recovery or something. Like even there, it sounds like you're doing some, like digging it, like what was the text and how did it get put together and why? And
right.
Is that right?
Yes. Lawyers work with words. I can see how you're thinking. Yeah. lawyers work with words. We work with texts. And if that's how you're trained and how you think, and you don't want to cabin it off and just think, I want to be sophisticated about words in one part of my life and in no other part of my life, then it's natural to look for confluences.
So at the very least, that sounds like an extension of your vocation. I mean, it sounds like you're just trying to put your abilities, your capacities at the service of the church.
Yes.
And that's beautiful. So then to expand the question, the next step, is there any connection, you know, of law and liturgy? Or if so, how do you see it?
So this is something I've wanted to write on for a while, and I've never written an article on it so far, but at some point I probably will.
Well, it's time for a hot take, Sam.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
So, well, this is not going to be
a very hot
take. Yeah. This is going to be a...
We're going to get him canceled.
Just warmer than Laodicean take, probably. I think there are similarities at the level of language, and there are similarities at the level of function, and those are not entirely separable. So let's start with function. Part of what law has to do is serve as a coordinating device. Law does lay out punishments, deterrence is an important part of the law.
And this is like law is the instructor of morality, right?
Yes.
That's the tradition.
That's right. So you think like the prologues in Plato's Laws to announce what the law is going to be.
And the prologues in Plato's Laws are like twice as long as the laws themselves, right?
Right.
The prologues are there to convince you that you should follow the law.
Right.
Yeah.
But even in 2022, where we tend to be much more skittish about a strong relationship between the magistrate's morality and the law, law still does a whole lot of coordination. Just think which side of the road you're driving on.
Yeah.
Like that is law's coordination. What the rules are for stop signs, like law's coordination. And then you just apply that through all of life.
Mm-hmm.
Because law has to deal with how you interact with strangers. Mm-hmm. You don't need a lot of law in the family, apart from things like domestic abuse, but you need a lot of law for how you interact with strangers.
Yeah.
And so law helps people coordinate their behavior. And as the society becomes more complex, the need for coordination increases. This is one reason why you have more laws.
This is just a fascinating connection because when you read, I teach Homer every fall, and so I'm sort of rereading it to get ready. And the theme of Homer's Odyssey is Xenia, right? Which is the guest host relationship. And so the whole point of the book is the lawless space of when you're traveling and you sort of arrive at a new place. And there's this attempt to establish the custom between stranger and host, right? And you sort of see these different examples of the people who get it right, people who get it wrong. And to maybe continue making this connection, there's a liturgy that takes place, right? Mm-hmm. The guest has to do a certain thing. The host has to do a certain thing. You know, you have to feed them. You can't sleep with their daughter. I mean, all of these things are, don't eat your guests.
They're under your protection while they're at your house.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And where you are most in stranger mode and you don't have explicit laws, then law needs to keep close contact with custom. This is why what you can do with other people's property has to be track the norms of the society. Mm. Like whether you can sit in somebody's car or not is if the law is too out of touch with the custom, it's not going to work well.
Yeah.
That's one function, coordination function of law. Liturgy also serves a coordination function.
Absolutely.
Now, when you think about liturgy, not in the sense that every church has a liturgy, because it like liturgy has worship, what everybody does.
Right.
But written liturgies, written prayers are one of their functions is to coordinate the behavior of everyone.
And is that distinction like the custom versus law distinction that we were making earlier? Because like the Baptists have a liturgy in the customary sense, right? This is what they do, kind of a written liturgy.
You know, you're
like
supposed to skip the third verse of the hymn, but tells you you're supposed to skip the third verse of the hymn.
Exactly.
Yes, it can be. And you could imagine particularly a need for a liturgy when you don't have customs established. Hmm. So you think Cranmer...
In 1549. That's exactly what's happening. Yeah.
Exactly. So heightened need for a written liturgy.
So that's kind of interesting. So it kind of... You can sort of reverse engineer customs using laws in certain cases if you have the right sort of conditions, which is what Cranmer does in 49, where he says, actually... No, not, you know, you're no longer going to be going to side chapels and offering things to, like, various saints. Now you're all going to be together praying these words in this order, doing these things. And then over time, that becomes ingrained in the sort of English psyche as a set of customs that are then sort of regulated by these laws.
Exactly. By law, you are ceding custom. And the same thing happens with the two books of homilies.
Mm. Okay.
Because you don't have, you've got a lot of priests who... are not accustomed to
preaching,
and certainly not accustomed to preaching the Reformed evangelical doctrines.
Mm, right.
And so how do you get people to do this? Well, here's a script. Use the script. You're coordinating the preaching throughout the country. So that's part of it.
So to switch to another Platonic category, which you do see in the laws, but you also see it in the Statesman and obviously in other places, would you say that Cranmer is operating as a lawgiver, as a founder, as a statesman who sort of has this insight into the needs of the people and then transforms the people into the direction they need to go by giving them the law? But what is the law? The law is the liturgy.
Right. It would be very Protestant of me to say yes.
Okay.
And I will say yes.
Okay. We are a very Protestant podcast.
But that is not going to be like the Eamon Duffy story. Stripping the altar, something like that. So it was very controversial. There were people who were very on board with it. There were people who very much loved the older ways, and then there was a large middle.
Right.
Now it's kind of interesting because you find yourself. I mean, you're not an ecclesial, you know, you're not a bishop, but you find yourself in kind of a similar place, right, where you're trying to sort of preserve the old ways in a certain sense, you know, and to kind of preserve the memory of and the kind of way of worship that has been passed down from Cranmer.
Well, no stripping of the Anglican altar.
No stripping. No. The Anglican altars are here to stay, folks. Right. You know, they're not going anywhere.
So one thing you said last night when we were when we sort of told you, you know, some of the things we were thinking of asking, but I don't think you said today, was that law, like liturgy, is best when it's stable.
Yes.
And we really don't want laws, right? If it's a really bad law if every couple of years we change...
You have to revise it.
Yeah, we change which side of the street you're going to drive on. Or actually, California is a great example of this because they change the laws about every 2 or 3 years because they can't decide whether the animal rights activists are correct that we should ban foie gras in the state of California, or if the, like, you know, hedonist people who want to eat really good food are right that, like, no, foie gras needs to be organic and local, so we should grow it here in California. So every year, they change, like, every 3 or 4 years. I think we're currently in it's banned, so I'm thinking of buying some here so I can, like, sell it on the black market when I get back to California. That's bad law, right? Similarly, the liturgy changes if the liturgy changes every week, in some way, this is a defective church because they're not admitting certain aspects of what it is to be human.
Right. I completely agree. So this is downstream, I think, from the coordination function.
Okay.
Is that you better achieve coordination with stability. So there are some similarities here. Stability is a virtue, all else being equal. Like stability of bad laws.
You don't want, like...
like need to keep Brown endings segregation is really good, and stability is not a sufficient
virtue to override that.
So ceteris paribus, all else being equal, it's a virtue to have stability in law. Exactly the same for liturgy. Mm-hmm. And of course, Cranmer's not doing stability vis-a-vis the late medieval. But once you have a good liturgy, stability is a gain. Now, there are some differences in what the benefits produced by stability are in these two contexts. So for law, one of the big advantages of stability is economic planning. So if you need to decide whether to open a restaurant that's going to have foie gras or not, it helps you to decide what kind of restaurant or farm or whatever else you're going to set up. You need some stability in the law. So constant flux in the law is bad economics.
Right.
On the liturgy side, it has more to do with memory and the way if you have one version of the, for in English for 300 years, you have one version of the Apostles' Creed being used. So you know the Apostles' Creed.
Right.
And
it sticks in the mind.
Exactly.
When you do it all, every week.
Yeah. And so now with more frequent alteration, it doesn't stick in the mind. Mm-hmm. And this also matters for intergenerational transfer. Mm-hmm. So what liturgy and the work of the church often aspires to is not just talking to people in this year right now, but rather it is an entire life of faith that is then handed down to one's children and grandchildren and it continues on. And so you get a whole bunch of people together and everybody sings Amazing Grace and they all know it.
Yeah.
That is something that is lost if every, that was last year, so you got to do this year.
Yep. I remember I got radicalized on this issue actually when I went to a church.
NSA, he doesn't mean it that way.
What?
Just to be clear.
Thank you.
Continue telling us about how radicalized you are.
Yeah, radicalized on this issue. But when I went to a very sort of like well-meaning, non-denominational evangelical service for Christmas Eve, and, you know, it's packed, it's much fuller than it usually is because people are coming to church on Christmas Eve, and they had us pray the Lord's Prayer together. This is kind of rare for this particular evangelical church. They had us pray the Lord's Prayer together, but they modernized it. And so everyone in the church, I guarantee almost everyone in the church knew the Lord's Prayer according to the prayer book tradition version, because that's the kind of dominant version in the United States. But because they modernized it, we all had to read the screens.
Right.
And we were like tripping over ourselves to figure out which alterations they made and didn't make. And it was it was just an attempt to be hospitable.
Yeah.
Right. Because they wanted it to be modern and friendly to new people who weren't used to it, who don't like the stodgy old language. But that's the language everyone knew.
Right.
So anyway,
I think you see that just generally with the Lord's Prayer, because we in English, it's the opposite of the experience that you're talking about in England, where for 300 years they had the Apostles' Creed in one formulation and everybody said it. I mean, there's so many formulations just of the Lord's Prayer that are used in the United States in English. Is it just like in the trespasses line, right? Is it forgive us our sins, forgive us our trespasses
or debts?
Yeah, forgive us our debts. And so you always see every time the Lord's Prayer is spoken, somebody in the room is sort of stumbling on that.
Yeah, the Presbyterians, sentence. We always say debts. You know, I mean, it's like
the reason for that is the influence of the King James Bible in England or in the United States and the relatively small size of the Episcopal Anglican tradition. So Tyndale uses trespasses, prayer book version uses trespasses, 1611 King James switches to debts. So for people whose exposure to the Lord's Prayer is almost all through King James, debts is natural.
Right.
If it's through the prayer book, it's trespasses.
And then if you're NIV or whatever, it's probably sins now, I think.
Yeah, so. But I think that gets instantiated in the Presbyterian tradition too, the debts language. But we should probably...
thing I wanted to say is, you know, and so this is probably a softball, but, you know, I've been listening to some theonomists, Sam, and so I kind of feel like, you know, you're a lawyer. Why don't we just let the Bible tell us what to do with the law? And similarly, you know, I go to this low church and we don't need a liturgy. We're just going to let the Bible tell us what to do in church. So why is this a bad idea?
Oh, it's a terrible idea.
But the prayer book's mostly Bible anyway.
You're saying this is the last question? And
really, we should have another podcast.
This needs hours.
Yeah.
It's a bad question for different reasons.
terrible question, Colin.
You asking the question is not bad. The person who thinks you should just read your laws off the Bible read the Bible in church. Both of those are disasters, but different reasons. So on the where your laws come from, I'll just make a quick.
But they're related disasters.
They're related disasters because they both. What's common to them is an exaggeration of the completeness of what you have from Scripture with respect to application.
Yeah. That's right.
So, so this is not to critique sufficiency mm-hmm. of Scripture for salvation. That's a basic Reformation doctrine. But the Bible is not telling you how to run your laws for streets and cars and all kinds of other things like that. So, and in magisterial Protestant thinking about the state and the duty of the magistrate, you've got the Decalogue, but how the Decalogue is going to play out in the society has to be specified.
Mm-hmm.
The determinatio of natural law, it's got to be worked out in a particular context, sensitive to prudence and the particular context. So first, like, disastrous idea to say we've got the Bible as our law code.
Yeah.
It's also not a good idea for liturgical reasons. Whenever anybody says, and here I know we've got some listeners who are regulated principle folks, but I find it completely unpersuasive because everybody does stuff that the Bible doesn't tell you to do. Right.
The example I always use is the Bible can't tell you how to do your taxes.
It can't tell you how to do your taxes.
It can't tell you whether you should play piano to accompany the hymns that aren't in the Bible.
It doesn't.
You
know, I mean,
can't tell you how to cook eggs.
It doesn't have a service bulletin.
Yeah.
There's no service bulletins in the Bible. There are no pulpits built in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're doing all kinds of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and you should just own up to the fact that the church, guided by the Holy Spirit, is supposed to make wise judgments about how to live in the world in any particular time.
Yeah, I think one of my responses to it would be to say, and the similarity is that there's a certain shirking of the human responsibility that takes place if you want to make those kinds of arguments. Not your arguments, yes. But the arguments of the people who I was sort of just, you know, mouthing earlier. Because the human has a responsibility of authority, both in the civil and the ecclesial space,
yes,
to figure out how it is that we are supposed to live in light of God's revelation.
So the one thing I would say, though, that I don't want to follow that line too far.
I do.
Because,
I want to go right off a cliff.
Because... Right. That's great. You will be consumed by fire with everyone else who approaches the mountain of the Lord inappropriately. But I think Sam's point about the application of principle, where it's the prudent application of the principles that God does give us, is important, because I do think the insight that the regulative principle is attempting to preserve really is important. Namely, we approach God on God's terms.
Yes.
We approach Him as He instructs us to approach Him. We do not have the freedom to approach Him in any way that we see fit. And I think that instinct of the regulative
yes.
principle is absolutely right.
Yes.
And that's the magisterial Protestant
yeah.
position. But
and
the,
I'm
the
not,
point is that
I'm not
this has to be applied.
That.
Well, I know, but yeah. your whole, like, freedom and judgments and, you know.
It's right out of Luther.
I do think this particular category that we tend to miss is the category of judgment.
Yeah.
So we tend to hollow out this judgment space and convert everything to either rules or discretion
right.
that seems arbitrary. We've lost the idea of a guided discretion judgment, which is a responsibility. It's a responsibility for authorities, civil authorities, which is why we should obey and respect however they make the judgments. Ecclesiastical authorities, why we should obey and respect however they make the judgments.
Right. You don't go church hopping just because you don't like the decision that they made about where to put the piano.
Right. And
unless it's really badly placed. I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, I've been to some churches where the piano is in a terrible location. But yeah, no, that's right.
Well, in the baptismal font,
in the
especially
yeah,
bad
well,
place.
That's
for
right,
the
that's true. That's particularly right. if it's an electric
yeah,
one.
Yeah, no, but I think that's well taken. So we should really start wrapping it up here, I think. So we're going to move on to the what we're reading segment. So Sam is our guest. Would you mind telling us what you're reading these days?
Gladly. So I'm reading different books about equity right now. I've got a stack of books on equity pleading and different equity treatises, because I'm going to be working on a new equity treatise.
That's the legal concept of equity is distinct from how equity is kind of used popularly
yes.
now, right? So it's kind of a very particular...
It's much like intersectionality. There's a number of other words which, like, have a legal meaning and then have a popular meaning.
Most of the popular meanings of equity do go back to the
they find the roots in it.
Meanings. So I usually have a P.G. Woodhouse novel going I'm listening to on audio, so I'm doing that. There's a new biography of by Elder on John Calhoun, who I'm listening to. He's I utterly reject his secessionism, but he's an important constitutional thinker that was influential before the Civil War. So I'm trying to get a little more about what's going on there. And I'm also starting City of God, which is going to be our midweek study at church throughout the summer.
Yeah, why don't you tackle something challenging, Sam?
All right, Colin, what are you reading?
I'm about to present a thing on C.S. Lewis and history and historicism. So I've been going through some of Lewis's writings about history and historicism, and then including two short essays that he has, and then a couple of pieces by Leo Strauss, who has a number of things to say about historicism. And so that might be showing up in my talk later today. But mostly when I'm at the Convivium, I'm thinking about running the Convivium. So that takes up a lot of my mental
space.
So
he's not reading, is what he's saying. He's not really reading.
I was definitely reading. You saw me sneaking in late to the session with an essay in hand that I was trying to plow through.
Right, that's true. Yeah. No, that's true. Well, for a kind of change of pace, I've been reading a novel. And for a real change of pace, I've been reading a spy novel. It's A Perfect Spy by John Le Carre. I don't know how to say his name. But anyway, it's supposed to be like his greatest novel, and he's actually supposed to be the guy who sort of made spy fiction respectable, sort of, you know, his prose is pretty good and so on. So I've started that, and it's pretty interesting. It's pretty enjoyable, but I don't think, probably I'll finish this, I'll enjoy it, and then I'll be done with his works, and I'll try to, you know, move on to something else, so... and then for the spotlight today, we'll move into our spotlight time. We're going to be spotlighting the 1662 Book of Common Prayer International Edition.
It's a little bro motion. You're going to get the Ad Fontes bump here, Sam.
That's right. The Ad Fontes sales bump. No, but actually...
Literally dozens of people.
But
by the 1662 prayer book from InterVarsity Press.
From InterVarsity Press.
Bright green, very beautiful.
Yeah. So, and it's actually apparently, you know, one of their best sellers. So that's what I overheard some InterVarsity staff talking, booksellers at the Evangelical Theological Society. And they said, it's one of their best sellers. It's a wonderful little book. It's actually beautiful. It's,
It really is.
The binding is beautiful. The cover is beautiful. Sam, you did the typesetting yourself, right? And it's just gorgeous. I mean, it's laid out perfectly. So highly recommend looking into that and using it for personal devotion or you know, whatever. And I think on that note, if you liked what you heard today, if you like, you know, us coming to you live from Convivium 2022, give us a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify. And if you didn't like what you heard today, Colin... what should they do?
If you didn't like what you heard today, I think you need to buy a plane ticket to South Bend, Indiana. And you need to go find Sam at his church in South Bend. It's a nice high church Anglican church. And you need to worship with them using the 1662 prayer book for at least a couple of weeks. And then if you still didn't like what you heard, then we'll let you give us a 1-star review. But not until then. If you don't do that, no 1-stars.
Everybody's welcome. Everybody's welcome. All right. Well, thanks. And with that, we are the editors. This is the Ad Fontes podcast. And we will see you next week.